Well, I think we can go ahead and get started. Just to remind everyone that this call is being recorded. And my name is Craig Schwartz. I'm part of ICANN's staff, and welcome to this consultation with the temporary drafting group on January 27th. What I'll do first is go ahead and do a roll call. And if I don't call your name, if you please would speak up and acknowledge that you're on the line, that would be helpful. We've got Jeff Newman, John Spencer, Jacqueline Conrad, David Maher, Greg Aaron, Eric Brunner-Williams, Michelle Nalon, Keith Drazik, John Nevitt, Ray, Z-Y-L-S-T-R-A, sorry Ray, I don't want to butcher your last name, Steve Del Bianco, Kathy Kleiman, we've also got Chuck Gomes, Barry Cobb, Ryan Cute, and repeating what Dan Halloran just said for the recording in Marina Del Rey is Dan Halloran, John Jeffrey, Kurt Fritz, Francisco Arias, Karen Lentz, Michael Salazar, and Kevin Espinola from Jones Day. Is there anyone who's on the line that I've missed?
Rick Wilhelm, Network Solutions.
Oh, hi, Rick. Sorry about that.
Of course.
Jim Prendergast, thank you. Are you there in the room with the VeriSign folks, Jim?
Yeah, those three are here at the VeriSign. That's Mike Malone, Jim Prendergast, and Joe Waldron.
John, it's a little bit hard to hear you. Maybe you're far away from the mic, but thanks. Did you say you said Joe Waldron also?
Yes.
Okay.
And did I hear Michael Young?
Yeah. Yes, you did.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
And Fabien Betremieu from AFNIC, representing the Paris Observer to the Registry.
Thank you, Fabien.
And James Mitchell from OSRI.
Hi, James. And that was from OSRI Registry. That was a little bit difficult to hear.
And Craig, it's Richard Tindall.
Hi, Richard. Wow, we've got quite a cast of characters today.
Craig, Scott Hemphill's on as well.
Hi, Scott. Anyone else?
Greg Shatton from Reed Smith and IPC.
Thanks, Greg.
And Craig, I think you have me, Kathy Kleiman, PIR.
Yes, thank you, Kathy.
And David Maher back on the line.
Thank you, David. We have you twice. So why don't we go ahead and get started? Is anyone having any issue getting into the Adobe Connect room? Okay, it doesn't sound like it.
I'm having a Craig, this is Jeff. I'm having an issue.
The issue is what?
It's stuck on the screen that says Adobe Connect, and it's not. I typed in my name, and
Is anyone else in the VeriSign room there able to get on? And are you projecting, or does everyone just have it up on their laptops?
Have it up on our laptops. We could project it.
Okay, thanks. That might make it easier for now.
Craig, it sounds like you might just need to approve Jeff Newman's entry into the Adobe room.
I don't have any pending approvals at the moment, but as soon as I see one, I certainly will accept it.
All right.
Thanks, Dan. So the ticking noise in the background seems to be coming and going, and the operator is working on it, just muting lines sequentially to try to determine whose line is causing the problem. So the folks should just bear with us while they take care of that. We will. Why don't we go ahead and get started? And so projected on the Adobe is the agenda for today. The four items: the continued registry operations instruments, the pricing for registry services, the registry code of conduct, and the termination of registry services agreement. In terms of moderating the call, various folks from ICANN staff will be handling different sections, and either John, Jeffrey, or myself will be moderating the Adobe Connect room for folks that raise their hands to ask questions. So with that, I'll turn the call over to John or anyone on his team or Kirk's team, for that matter, that might like to make an opening remark, and we can do the same for the folks on the phone.
Hey, Craig, this is Dan Haller, and I won't give any big speech, but just a very quick one. Thanks to everyone for joining us again, and these are usually very productive substantive calls, so I'd like to just jump right into the first item, the continued registry operations instrument. And we don't have any big speeches, I don't think, prepared on this one either. Maybe we could lead off if someone from the registries, I think, have proposed edits to this, or they have comments on it, and maybe they want to just kick it off by introducing those their comments and concerns, and then we can go back and forth.
So this is Kurt, I'll start. The continuing operations instrument was born out of the goal to protect the interests of registrants, which of course is a first and foremost for all of us, but also has been brought up by ESSAC and members of that community and at large. How are we going to protect registrants, particularly in the with the idea that with innovation and advancement also comes failure, so it's anticipated that some registries would fail. And then also understanding that, we think the application questions and scoring is, close to as good as it can get, but at the end of the day, it's a series of promises. What device could we create to actually provide some assurances that registrants' investment in domain names and all the associated infrastructure and development and marketing will not suddenly fail. And so, inside staff and outside, the idea was hit upon about some way to continue registry operations in the event of a registry failure, particularly in the case where there might not be a successor registry readily available. And so we hit upon the idea of jointly of having a mechanism in place for providing that. So how does that get paid for? We explored a number of different options and met with the banking community, other communities to determine how many different options we could put in the guidebook for providing different forms of backup. And at the end, after a lot of work, I wound up crossing all of them off the list for a variety of reasons, and we're left with the one that's here, which is securing this financial instrument. So now, admittedly, that happened over a year ago. So, economies change and availabilities change, and so, it might be worthwhile exercise to explore the other options for providing this service. Maybe some have become viable where they weren't before, or maybe this one's become more difficult than others. So, understanding that. But at the end of the day, the big message for us is that there's one question, one duty for applicants in the entire application process that will serve in a concrete way to protect the instruments of registrants, the interests of registrants, by ensuring ongoing registry operations for a while, and that's this maintenance of the basic registry services through some sort of instrument that ensures their ongoing operation for a period of time.
Jeff indicated there are questions in the VeriSign room, so if somebody wants to start there, go ahead.
Maybe not. I thought there was. I think one of the issues, though, we're having, a lot of us are talking either as applicants ourselves or with others, and they're just not sure how to plan for the amount, or if there's multiple TLDs, why you would need multiple instruments, or could you just have one instrument?
there's a lot of discussion of the uncertainty of whether what they would propose is sufficient. Are there any more guidelines you all can give?
You can have one instrument for multiple, as long as it covers the cost.
Can you get to speak a little closer to the mic?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's really difficult to hear you, Jeff.
I don't know.
Can you hear me?
So I think that's something that can be. Sorry, this is Mike Salazar. I'm the GCHLD program director. So I think that's something that can be considered. However, you'd have to look at ensuring that the costs for all of the critical functions are covered across all applications. That has not been considered in reviewing the applications. We'd have to be sure that we would have all of the applications that would be evaluated that would be covered by that instrument in a group.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah, you sound very distant, but we can hear you.
An answer to another part of your question, Jeff, might be that, we contemplate all different sizes and shapes of new registries, and so wanted to make the satisfying the requirement flexible based on the anticipated business model of the registry. So that's why, just like in other parts of the application, so that's why you don't see a specific dollar amount, but rather ask the registry operator applicant to calculate the cost for maintaining those five basic functions of a registry, and then based on their business model, and then providing for that, and then it's up to the evaluator to say, yeah, this is a reasonable amount, or geez, this seems way out of bounds.
Well, so this is Jeff. Can you guys hear me? Still distant. Well, all right. For example, if you're paying a back-end registry operator a certain cost to do all these functions, is that the amount?
You on mute?
No, forget it.
I'll type it in.
So it sounded like Jeff's question was, if you're paying someone to do your back-end services, is that what the amount needs to be for the COI? Is that what those costs total need to be, what you pay that operator?
Sorry, guys. We're discussing this. We'll get back to you in a few minutes or a second. Sorry.
We need the mic cam.
So sorry, guys. So we're coming up with what we're talking about is what the cost is for this. So as an example, is Dot Museum a good example to use? So Core uses, Core is the back-end registry provider, right? Core charges some amount of money to run these five core functions. What is that amount? That's the amount that needs to be covered over the three-year period. How are we going to get to that amount? That's probably going to come or should be coming through the application process. Right. So now, if museum goes away as a business and we need to invoke the COI, and Core says, hey, you know what, we don't need to go to an emergency back-end provider. We can actually run these services, but they're going to want to get paid for it. How do we pay Core? because museum now doesn't have the funds to pay CORE. So we have to invoke the COI to cover those costs. The only place that we get those costs is through the application. I don't believe we have asked the applicant to go through and estimate the cost to run these five CORE services using somebody other than who they expect to use as their back-end provider.
But without, but ICANN's not necessarily guaranteeing. I'm just trying to think through the transition plan we've set up. And it's not a sure thing that, let's say museum does fail, we're trying to set up this emergency back-end operator, which might be the operator or not. It wouldn't necessarily just stay at the current back-end operator. In fact, in lots of cases, it wouldn't.
Right. Maybe. I mean, again, if the back-end, so it's a riskier proposition to transfer those services to another back-end provider. If CORE's already running them and they're doing a good job of running them, and they agree to now run them in the event that museum goes down, would you want to then still transfer it to an Ebro? I mean, that's a decision that needs to be made.
All right, so we have two hands up. One is Eric, who's put some comments on the chat. But Eric, did you want to talk to this?
Yes, thank you very much, John. This is Eric Werner-Williams, not of CORE, although I have been for quite some time. The issue I'm attempting to point out in comments is that we treat all applications separately. Now, I've been trying to get that changed for quite some time, but that's the way it is right now in the application guidebook and in the evaluation processing model, as I understand it. Here, Jeff is proposing that applications share some properties, share some fate, in this case, the cost of the continuity instrument. I think that we have the more general problem of deciding whether or not applications can share some property. For instance, two applications by one applicant for two different scripts. Is there any cost saving there, or do they get charged both the full price? So, that was really all the comment I wanted to make on Jeff's proposal. I support it in principle, but it puts in question our independence of each application assumption. Thank you. And then when it's my turn, I'd like to speak to my issue.
We just, so you know, the VeriSign location is transitioning to a room that's got better microphone. So if you give us about 60 seconds, we'll be there.
Why don't we pause? Do you want us to pause for a couple of minutes while you relocate?
We're moving 15 yards, so we'll be right there.
All right. So, Richard Tindall, was your question or comment on the same line, or do you have a new comment line?
This is Richard. It's kind of a general comment.
All right. Then, does anybody else have any comments on the current issue?
Let me hang this up.
We'll pause for a second to see if the VeriSign room does.
Could you repeat that? We were just getting into the new room.
No problem. So we're at the point where we were asking whether there are any additional comments or questions relating to that line of questioning that was just discussed. I know Jeff Newman put a couple of comments on the chat. Did you want to express those, Jeff? Or Mike Salazar can answer and summarize it.
Yeah, so Jeff brought up a good comment that it's critical that we provide some examples like the one that I just talked about, and I agree. I think there is some confusion between a registry's business continuity plan to recover internal processes and which would recover a critical process in the event that the owner of the registry either dissolves or their business continuity plan is unable to recover timely one of those five critical functions.
Right, and I think, thanks, yeah. The point I think Eric was kind of, and I were talking about too, is that you could have a front-end operator providing multiple strings in whether it's different scripts, as Eric said, or just, you know, just different strings but same model, and it could be the same cost. You're not just going to multiply the cost times two or times the number of strings. you know, the cost may be the same, whether it's one, two, or three strings, or four. And I think that's the kind of thing that needs to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, so I think how they're going to fill out the application is a challenge, right? Because my assumption is that there would be some incremental cost in running two strings versus running one.
If I could jump in, it's very little. I mean, it's really the cost of an incremental report on a registry that is unchanging, and very modest and extremely modest amounts of maintenance. So if you were in the business of attempting to cost this out, you probably would write it off at zero.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, you know, you talk about a continuing instrument, but could it be one instrument that covers multiple TLDs? Because it's not just how you fill out the application. I mean, these guys that we're all talking to are asking us the question, if I have five strings, do I need five continuing operations instruments, or do I need just one that covers the five? Because that affects their costs, their business models. We just need more clarity.
Hi, this is Francisco Arias from ICANN. About the incremental cost, I think there will be some incremental cost if you are running another TLD. Remember, you have to run the five critical functions, DNS, WHOIS, EPP, data escrow. There will be some incremental costs for doing that for another TLD.
Yes, Francisco, we know this, but it's very small, and if you actually attempt to measure it, you're spending more money measuring it than it actually takes to do it. So when you've got lots of them, the incremental cost is effectively zero. How do we deal with that?
Sorry, guys. We're discussing this right now. We'll get back to you in a few seconds here.
So Jeff, is the request that if one entity applies for multiple TLDs, they can get one letter of credit?
That's one of the questions, comments. Yes.
So we'll look at that. I don't know. In our really brief discussions here, we're talking about if that request has zero effect. In other words, if you're working with a bank, they may choose to combine them anyway, or if you're working with a bank, they may choose to separate them anyway. So. At the end of the day. Anyway, we'll take that as a request and see if we can work it out with
Go ahead. Can I ask a question then, Jeff, in that scenario? If you've got three TLDs covered by a single instrument and you sell off one of the TLDs, what's going to cover the 3 years worth of reserve, worth of operations of that critical functions for the TLD that just been sold?
Well, I think I you raise an interesting hypothetical, and I think if one is sold, then when ICANN's looking into the whole process of, you know, the transition as is required under the guidebook, then that's one of the issues that ICANN could address at that point in time. I don't think we need to, you know, come up with a solution right now to that problem. I think that's an excellent question for when the registry sells off one of their TLDs.
Okay.
All right, are there any more comments on this line? Then I think Eric had the next comment. And then Richard Tendell follows.
Thank you very much, John. This is Eric Brunner-Williams. And I'm wearing the JAS hat, Joint Application Support Working Group, although I'm not officially delegated to this group to ask any questions. I'm asking them with that perspective. in the first instance, the issue of application support comes up here because this is a financial commitment that the applicants are making, and we have the issue of how to deal with applicants who are qualified for support, however that qualification is determined elsewhere in the ICANN process. The burden upon applicants who are needs qualified is increased significantly by the financial-only form of the instrument. And so I propose that that delegations of to continuity operators, typically regional CCTLD operators, be a allowed form of the continuity function guarantee. And then as a more general note, to continue with the previous, not merely the designation of operators, but also membership in a risk pool, so that there's self-insurance without necessarily using a back-end operator such as CORE, Afilias, Neustar, or VeriSign in order to obtain the effective discount that Jeff has just discussed, providing only 1/n of the fees for each of N applicants. The broader, or the non-JAS issue, is that the protections that we're discussing here don't really go far enough. They protect the existing registrants in their property interests or whatever interests they have in the registrations, but they don't protect their interest in the registration policy which existed during the lifetime of the now defunct registry operator. And I think that's an important issue to consider, as we don't want to repeat the dot travel experience of starting off with something and ending up with something entirely different after a transition of control. I'll take comments or answer questions. Thank you.
Sure. This is Francisco Arias again. When transitioning a TLD, the process state that if it's a community TLD, the community will be consulted, and they have to at least not object to the new operator, and same thing with geographic TLDs.
That's very good, Francisco. That does clarify considerably the issue of maintaining the registration policy or the locality of interest that somehow is part of the meaning of the namespace as far as the registrants are concerned.
All right, Eric, this is Dan Haller, and I'll just a couple quick thoughts on some of your other lines of thinking there. On the idea of instead of having a financial instrument of designating another operator to take over, that sounds to me like the same kind of thinking we were exploring when we talked to, it probably goes back a couple years ago now, and I think you might have been involved in those conversations, idea of ICANN accrediting back-end operators.
Yeah.
The first problem we'd run into there, if we, instead of allowing a financial instrument, if we let registry operators designate a backup operator, is we'd have to be sure that that backup operator was qualified and capable of taking on the operation, A, and then B, we'd have to make sure there's some kind of binding commitment from that backup operator to actually serve as the operator, because we wouldn't want an operator to say, my back-end operator is, Neustar, and then that registry operator fails, and we go to Neustar and say, hey, Neustar, you're the backup operator for this, and they say, says who, or, we have no contract, or basically it could just be an illusory promise. So we'd have to kind of build a new program to be able to implement that, which was, in large part, the back-end operator program, which I think the general idea we got to was that it was a little too complicated to bite off for this first round of the new GTLDs, but it was an idea. We did get a lot of interest from CC operators, from existing operators and others about back-end accreditation. So that might be a way to go, possibly in subsequent rounds. And your other idea on the risk pool, I think, we're willing to, explore or look at that. We're definitely having an open mind on this whole subject. I think the biggest problem with that is, as we've seen with the whole mortgage meltdown of the financial crisis, is lumping a bunch of risks together doesn't necessarily mean you're decreasing your risk. If we put five registries together in a risk pool, all five of those registries could go under. There's no guarantees in this or anything else. So instead of, you know, cutting the risk and spreading it, we might be compounding it. And that would be just our first concern on that risk pool idea.
Well, thank you, Dan. I'm glad to hear the reference to the continuity program that we discussed. It's been now 3 years, I think. I think there will be applications from ccTLD operators, and I think you should consider it. I don't want to go too much further and consume too much time in this. About the risk pool, I mean, this is insurance, and if insurance doesn't work, I don't think that everything fails simultaneously. That's a low likelihood of an event. But I take your point. Thank you very much.
Richard Kendall is next in the queue.
Richard, did you want to comment?
Yeah, thanks. It's Richard. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, there we go. That's better. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
But, yeah, so it sounds like I may be in the minority here, or maybe not. I'm not sure. But it seems to me that the principle behind this is really quite clear. I think it's quite clearly articulated in the guidebook. And the language that's been provided seems to me to be also quite clear. It gives latitude for applicants to explain a particular approach that they might take, or a model or a justification they might have for whatever sort of cost basis they come up with. So, you know, I think the language is pretty good. It seems to me that it works. It's been refined over the last year and a bit, and for what it's worth, I think that the current language is quite adequate.
All right, if there are no more comments, we're going to go on to the next topic area then.
This is Dan Halloran. So the next item on the agenda is pricing for registry services. And the agenda notes, we welcome a proposed solution
joined
on this, and that address the concerns and retain the notice requirement. So we've talked both in these meetings and at Cartagena in previous meetings about our general idea behind this this entire pricing provision, and the fact that we're not ICANN is not going to act as the central pricing committee establishing, you know, what the price is for each TLD and what price increases are allowed or what's reasonable or anything like that. Instead, we're going to let the market function and set prices, but we've put in this one provision requiring notices, so there's registry RARs and registrants have time to adjust when prices are going to change. And we've gotten comments ranging from, you know, on one side, this isn't good enough. ICANN needs to set all prices for all TLDs, and this will lead to abuses. On the other side, continuing comments that we should just drop this altogether, and ICANN has no business even monkeying at all with price mechanisms, price policies, price procedures. And ICANN should leave this completely to the market to set prices. What we've got then is we've continually refined this. We're up to the fifth draft now, and it's gone through various iterations. And we've received comments, including detailed comments again from the registries, and we're still the comment period just closed 12 days ago, and we're still processing the comments. One particular one we want to talk about today is the comments we got from the registry stakeholder group on one particular provision in this pricing provision, and so this is on 2B, and this is dealing with the notice provision regarding the price of renewals in the registrations. In previous drafts, ICANN had put in this rule saying that registry operators have to have uniform pricing for registration renewals. And in this last draft, we clarified that meant the price would have to be the same for each domain registration across different domains. So the registry couldn't pick, you know, for this second level registration, the price is this much. For this second level registration, the price is that much. And although we did have this provision for sort of premium registrations where the registrant with clear and conspicuous disclosure and the consent of the registrant could opt into sort of a premium domain pricing that would have higher prices than a usual routine registration. And so in this latest round, and we've gotten the comment back in the last couple of drafts, the registries were concerned this might limit their ability to offer discounts, incentives, and rebates. And so in this latest draft, our understanding of it is, and maybe the registries can talk to this and explain their intent. My understanding of the edits we got back on this provision is that they want to specifically on the provision requiring uniform price registration for renewals, the registries would like there to be an exception to that, basically, so that the registries could offer refunds, rebates, discounts, and other programs of a limited duration that are clearly and conspicuously disclosed to the registrar, and that would be an exception to the requirement to have a uniform renewal price for all registrations. So first, I wonder if someone in the registries could talk to that, make sure I got that right, and then maybe talk about the rationale for that, and maybe even, if possible, kind of examples of how that might work.
Okay, this is Jonathan Spencer, and, you know, yes, that is the intention here, is to allow registries, as they do currently, to be able to offer marketing incentives and programs to registrars that encourage renewals of registrations. I think that, you know, even new TODs particularly will want to be able to do this to maintain traction in the marketplace, to focus on particular verticals that are of importance to them. And, you know, I think this is, you know, something that is beneficial to registrants, because these discounts tend to get passed through or included in part of packages from the registrars. And again, you know, here is just simply to say, you know, we want to make sure that there's that flexibility there, that, you know, the parties will have a robust ability to compete in the marketplace, and that, again, you know, limited duration, I think everybody benefits from these things.
Hi, Jonathan. This is Kevin Espinola. And when you're talking about these programs that would encourage renewal registrations, I assume you're talking about programs that would be offered on a non-discriminatory basis, meaning there wouldn't be programs that target certain registrations. Programs would be offered registrars and would apply to all registrations.
Right. I mean, you know, this is consistent with language in the current registry agreements. Allowing this allows everyone to give an you know, everybody should have the opportunity to qualify for these things. You know, there may be situations where a particular registrar's business model is different and wouldn't tend to take advantage of it, but, you know, we always do our programs, and all the registries do the programs, that, you know, the guideline that we follow is that all registrars have the same opportunity to qualify, that if their business, if this is where they focus their business, you know, they'll be able to do it. Doesn't mean that every registrar would have equal impact on every registrar, but, you know, they all have the ability to qualify and take advantage of the incentive equally.
As long as it's meeting that objective set up in the program to address a certain market vertical or
right.
geographic.
You know, for there. Example, you know, we've done ones where it's a particular market region or an area, and maybe the requirement is that the registrar has language support for that market, you know, so that might be a requirement, you know, and it's set up in a way that all registrars can have, that, you know, would be able to develop that capability, but, you know, not every registrar may have that language support to decide to go that route, and then they wouldn't qualify for the discount or the incentive.
Okay, so it wouldn't be, Kevin, again, this, so it wouldn't be, I'm just picking South, you know, South, for all registrars in South America, this is a program we're offering. That what you're contemplating would be for all registrars that can service Spanish-speaking regions of South America, we are offering this incentive.
Well, it could be for all registrars that want to do business in South America. You know, we try to give enough time for registrars to qualify that, but the market may be focused on having the ability to service that market. Okay? But again, okay. It's open to all registrars. It's not limited to registrars who are, you know, we try to avoid a restriction that, you know, would limit on that base, that automatically disqualifies a registrar up front. You know, we can try to give opportunity and give notice and people opportunity to, you know, to structure their business to take advantage of it.
Okay, give us 1 second here. Thanks.
Then one last follow-up question, Jonathan. I understand now the registrar universe as it relates to what you're contemplating. How about the registrant / registration universe? That would be non-discriminatory, right? It would any program would apply across the board.
Yeah, well, we only sell to registrars, so yeah, it would apply to would apply across the board.
So the program to the registrars wouldn't be all registrars are able to participate in this program, provided that you know they were the registrar for the following 10,000 names or following 2 million names or something.
Yeah, this is Dan Heller. Let me jump in again.
No, it would not be name specific. No, it would be that you know if it's a renewal, it'd be focusing on obtaining renewals, you know, within a region, because it might be tied to a marketing effort. So there might be marketing collateral or something, you know, but it wouldn't be tied to a specific name. If that makes sense.
This is Dan Heller. Thanks for that. And so I think Kevin and I are kind of, I think we have a direction we can work on here with the understanding that it's not, that what, it sounds like what the registries are wanting to offer is the same kind of incentive, general renewal, rebate, discount thing, you know, incentives to get registrars to, let's say, increase their renewal rates or, but we're not seeing is, or what we'd craft language to avoid is registries being able to cherry pick particular names and say, or classes of domain names and say, for this kind of domain name, we're going to have a higher price, or for this kind of domain name, we're going to have a lower price, which is the flip side of saying that same thing.
Right. No, and this is Joe Walder. So I think that, it's easy to understand kind of that model and the way that Jonathan described that for geographic regions, but you're right, there are other types of programs that you may do. So let's say you want to do a renewal program and you have some incentive for, you know, domain names that have live websites or domain names that have e-commerce or blogs, right? So you may do something that's very specific in a certain business objective that you have for some market vertical. So it's really not focused on individual domain names. It's focused on categories or certain objectives that you're trying to do, or it could be geographic regions. So I think there are a number of variables that you look at.
Right.
But you aren't looking at specific registrants. You aren't looking at where the registrar is incorporated. It's really where the business is occurring and whether it's in the specific market that you're trying to address.
Yeah, or timing-wise, you want to encourage early renewals. You know, you want to say, I want to run a program for those of you that renew in the next, you know, 6 months. You're going to get this, even though their renewal is not due for 2-3 years.
Yeah, it would always be a category based on the business or the thing. It would never be based on what the domain name is.
Unless the only exception is unless there was that kind of structure at the outset of the registry.
Right.
If the registry says these types of domain names are a certain price.
Yeah.
Then that could continue upon renewal.
So if you had something that would be specific to single character names or two character names,
premium
or
domain name,
premium whatever becomes premium. Yeah.
So hold on, guys. So I think we already had in the last draft the unless the registrar has provided registry operator with demonstration, that last phrase after the parenthetical you guys have inserted, we already had that to cover premium registrations. The rule you guys are adding your but excluding the application on is the requirement for uniform pricing for registration renewals in the absence of registrant notification about premium. So you're talking about, my understanding was you would have a uniform flat price. You would say, you know, our standard renewal price for all registrations is $10 or $5 or $20 or $2, whatever it is. And you couldn't charge more for any renewal. And you guys are inserting a but excluding an exception to that rule for these rebates, refunds, discounts. And we're trying to distinguish between discounts that would be available on an equal basis to all registrars. And where I thought we were trying to drive, or Kevin and I are trying to understand, is what about, excluding this ability to cherry pick particular registrations. And it sounds like you guys are okay with that too, but this idea of setting criteria on the registration level, I think, could be problematic and go against the original idea of this. I mean, let's say the registry wanted to say any registration that does more than 10,000 hits a day the renewal price is higher. Or any registration that does more than $1 million in e-commerce per day, the registration price is higher. So that gets into what we've noted is the intent of this, which is to not let the registry cherry pick and profit off successful individual registrations and try to capture that value for the registry itself, but instead to have a flat pricing for all registrations that aren't acknowledged as premium registrations.
So do you think the language that's proposed here allows that type of behavior? Because I'm not reading it that way.
So
you would have a program that would actually raise the price of a renewal of something that had higher DNS volume or something.
The registry, not to give you guys any bad ideas, but the registry could say our renewal price for all domains is $1 million per year. But we're offering a special discount of 99.9% for any registration that does less than $1 million per year in e-commerce, or that gets less than 10,000 hits. So your effective renewal price for all registrations is $10, but you're able then to pick $1 million off those successful registrations.
Great idea. I mean, sorry.
Yeah. I've added that idea.
Thank you very much.
So that's exactly the thing we were trying to stop, and then we don't. So I think Kevin's saying we're understanding the idea. We want to continue to allow you to offer discounts and rebates to allow incent registrars to get renewals, whatever. But the intent, and we'll try to come up with language, was to prevent that kind of what the community comments we got back saw as potential abuses of this.
And this is Kevin again. And what we struggle with is every sentence we write in this arena, we have to, at the same time, on a blackboard or a whiteboard, figure out how it can be gamed. And it's very a provision like this one is easily gamed. Every time we write something, we try to figure out how can we stick to the original intent of and focus of the provision while not being too restrictive, but at the same time not leaving, highway-sized gaming holes for people to drive through.
Well, we understand that, and I mean, I understand that, we could probably, maybe there's a statement as far as the intent of this not to allow that sort of thing, but I mean, on the converse, we have tended to want to incentivize where the domain name is active to actually discount that to encourage renewal or to encourage registrars to do things to make sure that a domain name is actively being used as opposed to being just not an inactive domain name.
Registered and no services built
because, an active domain name is stickier, has a greater chance of future renewal
and more benefit to
the registrar. It really, at least our tendency has been to do the opposite, was actually to give more discount for the busier it's been than the reverse,
Yeah, and then we're not trying to say that that's not the intent. Yeah. And quite frankly, at least from my perspective, responsible companies like VeriSign and others of the world aren't, this is Kevin Espinel speaking, my concern. It's the other, potential registry operators out there who have struggling registries at some point, who will then modify their intent over time to figure out how to stay in business and or increase profits.
Well, I think that maybe that's just to put in here, rather than try to close all of the gaming loopholes, is to just clearly state what the intent is.
Yeah, I mean,
and we understand what you're saying, and clearly certain aspects of it we're not pushing back on, and we'll figure out how we best can revise it to provide sufficient ability for registry operators to have marketing plans and programs that will promote commerce and promote the TLD that they own as opposed to the
opposite. Promote the development of the registry for whatever that its intent is, because that's going to be different for each TLD. So I think that's what should be stated as the intent is to promote the registry or enable the registry to have the flexibility to develop their TLD, through including the marketing programs that will do that, and then you need to put the condition in there that says while not
enabling the registry to attempt to share in the
or
extort
target
target the main, you know, the successful,
however,
you know.
How are you kind of phrase the cherry picking concern?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll do some more thinking on our side.
Okay. There were a couple of hands still up on that. Michelle and Richard, did you still want to make some comments? Michelle?
I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were talking to me. I mean, just as a registrar, I understand that you're trying to word things in such a way that a registry operator couldn't, jack up the price on particular domain names. I mean, under the current situation, there are incentives given to us as registrars to increase the renewal rates. And I know that in some CCTLDs, they've tried this kind of premium thing by charging, say, €1,000 for domain one dot whatever, and then €10 for all the normal ones. And the reality from our experience has been that they get a short-term gain, but they lose in the long run, so it doesn't really work for them. And if you're looking at a space where there are potentially hundreds of TLDs all competing with each other, it would be business suicide for a registry to do that. I can't see why registrars would want to keep doing business with people who kept on shifting the goalposts.
Thanks, Michelle. Richard, did you still want to make a comment?
I did, yeah. It's Richard Tindall. And agree with what Michele just said. I think we all understand that there's sort of strong business incentives for registries not to engage in this behavior, but I understand that there could be some sort of rogue behavior. It seems to me that we all kind of agree on what the primary goal here is, and that's to sort of stop that sort of extortionate type renewal pricing on registrants who've developed their sites, et cetera. So I think we should all keep in mind that's the sort of the key goal of this. But I'll point out that we've got that 6-month warning in there already, right? So, in the event that there is that sort of dramatic price increase, the existing registrant does have a 6-month warning, and they do have the ability to buy up to 10 years' worth at the pre-existing renewal price. So I think there's already a pretty powerful safeguard that you've built in there for the primary objective here. The language that we have at the moment, I'm okay with. I think what's in the applicant guidebook works for me. What the registry stakeholders group have proposed, that little amendment that they put in on the renewal piece, that also works for me. So I'm sort of happy with both what's there at the moment and with what the registry guys have proposed. Thanks.
All right, thanks for that, Richard. Any other comments on this pricing issue, or should we move on to the code of conduct? All right, so on the code of conduct, when we last talked in Cartagena, we noted that it was the version that was in the proposed final applicant guidebook was first rough draft of the code of conduct, and it borrowed heavily from language in the old agreements. And we were inviting, definitely detailed comments on every bit of it, and we did get back from the registries, especially. Off the top of my head, I don't remember. We got comments from other stakeholders, too, on general concerns and issues with the code of conduct. Mostly the other comments, if I can grossly summarize, dealt with dot brand and making sure that the code of conduct would work with dot brand, sort of single registrant TLDs. And the registries also have provided, and Jonathan sent around today, sort of detailed red lines. I wonder if Jonathan or someone else in the registries, if you want to walk us through your comments and your suggested edits on this.
Happy to do so. I will caveat that not all the changes that would be necessary to reflect dot brand are reflected in the red line that got sent around. So I apologize for that, and I will sort of defer to some of the other folks on any suggestions in that regard. So the first change, and one change to begin with, is would have to be made in the base agreement, which is to say that the registry code of conduct, basically applies, except with respect to the designated TLD. So, the first item here is that this conduct should apply to the TLD that is, for which the registry is being signed, and not
broadly for all TLDs a registry may be involved in that may not be ICANN TLDs or may be subject to other agreements and other terms. Coming down to the specification, you know, our first concern is that the initial language here that regarding affiliate or, you know, a subcontract or any related entity was overly broad. And I'm sorry, this markup is now, it should be deleting subcontract or other related entity, is overly broad. And as written here, an entity that has nothing to do with registry services, a subcontractor who has nothing to do with the provision of registry services, their activities all of a sudden get pulled into this code of conduct. And so a registry operator now becomes responsible for an activity by a subcontractor that, you know, has nothing to do with the provision of registry services, that may also be a subcontractor or party with a registrar.
So you're taking the word subcontractor out?
Taking the word subcontractor.
Even though it's not deleted here.
It should be deleted here,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Jonathan. Can I stop you right there? This is Kevin
sure.
again. So on your point as to the base agreement in 214, I understand that concern, and I at least am sympathetic to it. Going to Section 9, or Specification 9, the lead-in language, I just want to make sure I understand the issue. From my perspective, deleting subcontractor doesn't work in and of itself. If we want to qualify the type of subcontractor and tie that to a subcontractor or other related entity that provides registry services, then I think that's something we probably can work with. Is that the main intent, that you want this to be tied to people providing the registry services?
Yes. I think it's, you know, the intention here, it needs to be that it's got to be part that's related to the operation of the TLD in some manner.
Related specifically to the designated TLD.
To the designated TLD,
right, but,
yes.
But I think if I understand this right, you also want to make sure that you're not responsible for other business that subcontractor may have with a registrar and our responsibility
yes.
to police that.
Yes,
right?
I mean, that the other element is, that's right. I mean,
okay.
I want to be careful that, you know, if somebody's, you know, let's take a simple case, let's say, you know, we're using somebody to provide hosting or facilities management, you know, Verizon, a AT&T, you know, they're a subcontractor, an IBM is a subcontractor, somebody who's in the technical space, you know, and providing something that actually may be associated with registry services, you know, and they also provide services to registrars. I don't want to have to be policing their agreements, and let's face it, IBM is not going to agree, you know, to any restriction on their ability to deal with the registrar.
That wasn't the intent. So, okay, I understand what you're saying.
So this is Dan. So subcontractors, you had subcontractors taken out completely, but it sounds like you're okay having subcontractors in if those subcontractors are providing registry services and if it's related to just the provision of registry services.
This is Jeff. I'm not sure that does it because, you know, let's say something is subbed out. Let's say, I don't want to use specific examples because I was crucified, but okay, I'll use Newstar. This is not going to be the case. But let's say Newstar subs out to Registrar A portion of the registry services, and the Registrar A also provides other services to other registrars. Why do we have to police what they do in other TLDs?
So let's go back to the, I said if it's tied to the registry TLD. So, I mean, let's go back to the museum example. That seems safe because we all know museum would never do anything wrong. If museum is contracting with CORE, CORE is a subcontractor, and it would not be okay if CORE was showing preference to a particular registrar for the .museum TLD. We would still hold museum responsible to make sure that CORE, its subcontractor for running the TLD, was providing non-discriminatory services to .museum registrars.
But is .museum going to have complete visibility into CORE's relationship with all of the registrars that exist that .museum is supporting?
Well, CORE, yeah. .museum would need to be sure that CORE was providing non-discriminatory .museum services to registrars.
specific to that example, CORE is not a registrar for museums specifically to provide that uniformity. So there is no possibility of CORE not providing that to all competing registrars.
So I think, let's say hypothetically, Dot Museum, you know, Muse Doma became an accredited registrar. We would want CORE to not show preference to Muse Doma, the affiliated registrar. This is all hypothetical upon hypothetical. We wouldn't want the subcontractor to show preference to the registrar affiliated with the main registry operator. Or to a registrar affiliated with the subcontractor.
So let me go back to Jonathan's example, because that's one that I'm still, I guess, trying to reconcile. So if we use AT&T as a network vendor, and they're supporting a TLD that we operate, because that's where all of our registry transactions come in, they are also, you know, AT&T is also providing network services to a registrar. You know, they are still supporting that TLD with that registrar. I'm not going to have that level of visibility, nor is it appropriate for me to expect that AT&T would disclose what services and what preferential treatment they may be granting to one registrar over another in terms of that relationship that they've got.
Sure. And this is not, this is, these kind of things are quite likely in
yeah.
certain cases. Like, for example, you know, registry operators have DNS nodes all over the place
mm-hmm.
in big comm and colo data centers and key points. And you can bet lots of registrars also have those services as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
So
I think the question, with regard to the subcontractor, you know, that's missing here is that I don't necessarily have control over what the subcontractor is doing. If I'm directing the subcontractor to engage in certain behavior, that's, I understand that, and I understand the need for a restriction on that. But if I've just, if I've subcontracted a particular service under an agreement, and you know, that's all my rights with respect to that subcontractor. If that subcontractor goes to choose to do something else with some, you know, with a registrar, I don't have control over that agreement. So, you know, I think what's missing here in this analysis is, you know, whether it's a registry or not a registry service, what that contractor does, you know, I don't have control over it. And, you know, I could put language in my agreement with them and ask them not to do certain things, but it's only, that's about as far, that's really only as far as I can be able to get, realistically.
You can also enforce that agreement.
Sort of, depending on the type of service it is. I mean, if it's, the more closer you get to a CORE, you know, where major subcontracting of a, you know, but if it is a service in a remote locate, you know, facilities for a node, I may not have a choice here. I may not have choice over who I use.
But we can't get to a situation where services are contracted out and then the registry operator throws up its hands and says, oh, it's contracted out. It's no longer, I'm no longer in the chain of responsibility.
Why would they be no longer in the chain of responsibility?
What I'm hearing is if I have a contract with a subcontractor and they go off and do things, I don't have the ability to enforce what my contract says against them.
This is Rick Wilhelm. I'm sorry. I don't get that contracting model, right? Because typically, and the attorneys on the thing should speak up. But you know, typically, if you pass on an obligation and they don't fulfill it, then they're in breach, and then there's indemnification and other stuff that kicks in.
That's particularly my point. You have
yeah.
a contract that provides for X and Y. And it could be positive or negative, X and Y. You then, as the contracting party, you can enforce those obligations. You have remedies against the party.
Right. That's why it's called a contract.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my point, exactly.
But guys, I mean, we talked about in the last example, Jeff, we talked about the last example about not having gaming. I mean, I could think of so many ways to game this, and it all comes out of your decision on vertical integration, which we're not going to revisit, but one thing we talked about in the whole vertical integration debate was not just registrars, but resellers and anyone else that's selling names. So if I just want to get around this, I'm just going to become a reseller as opposed to a registrar and just get around the entire restriction. And then I think, you know, there are companies that provide DNS, for example, that may be a subcontractor, And even, and that company may also provide DNS to registrars as registrars, and you better bet that there's going to be differential pricing, and you know what? Some of those names will be in that TLD, or may be in that TLD. It's not like the DNS provider necessarily would say specific to a TLD if it's providing DNS. It usually provides DNS to whatever domain names that registrar owns or hosts or whatever else. So I understand what you're trying to do. I just think that this doesn't, this is easily gamed. It won't mean anything. And for the people that do follow it and aren't the gamers, it's actually going to be much broader than what you intended to do.
And I guess I'm still not understanding the behavior, the potential behavior you're trying to restrict by leaving the subcontractor in.
So this is Dan again. What we're trying to, our concern with the proposed edit here is that it would be a humongous exception to the entire code of conduct that registry operator would not, the code of conduct would not apply at all to subcontractors. So only registry operator would have to not provide preferences. We explicitly added subcontractors, meaning if the registry operator, let's say I'm .example Inc. and I hire, some other company to run the entire back end, we don't want that other company to be violating the code of conduct.
I thought registry operator and registry services provider was considered interchangeable for purposes.
Well, registry operator in this scheme is the company that enters the contract with ICANN concerning the operation of the TLD, but they're free to contract out to some other company to provide some of the services.
Right. So the
terminology is a little confusing. Separate from the registry operator.
A better term for what you've just described then would be to refer to the registry, something more specific like the registry services provider versus just subcontractor.
Right.
Because now you're talking someone that really is doing the heavy lifting behind registry functions and operations, and that would be appropriate and an appropriate limitation. But just general subcontractor, you're talking about the person that, delivers pizza for lunch and prints the brochures, as McCallie said, and it gets silly, right? Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, we're fine with that concept, to be clear.
Yeah, we agree. I mean, up front we said we understand the comment and we're, inclined to make it clear that the whole code of conduct applies just to the registry TLD, and that what we're talking about here is not every single contractor of the registry operator, but just those that are providing registry services. So I don't think it would apply, for example, one of the ideas tossed out was network services, or let's say office space, or whatever it is. If it's not a registry services provider, as you put it, then that would not be subject to this.
Or waiver stencil.
But there are tricky cases with that. So let's go back to the DNS example. One of my subcontractors is one of my transit providers in one of my nodes. Okay, and it turns out that they have been not a very good net neutrality player, and they've been bandwidth throttling some registrars that also happen to be their customers because they own their own registrar and they like to give themselves a competitive advantage. And all said registrars, including the transit provider, happen to be buying domains from my registry. Am I culpable now for their behaviors? I think I am the way this is written.
Yes, I think we want this to make sure if you're the .example registry operator, we want your services to be under this code of conduct, whether you operate them or whether your contractor operates those registry services.
Well, how would I know that my transit provider has some subsidiary businesses where they're playing these kind of games around? It's impossible for me to detect that.
So I think we would want you to contract with the operator and say, hey, you're going to run these back-end services for me. I'm obligated to provide them in a non-discriminatory manner. I want you to promise me that you'll also do that, because if we detect that there is discrimination or some violation of the code of conduct, ICANN's going to come to you, the registry operator, and say, hey, you're violating the code of conduct, you're discriminating against the registrars, you're in breach, and you're going to want to be able to address that with the company you hired to run the DNS.
Yeah, and I think if we all felt very confident that the cure would be, hey, registry operator, you've got a bad subcontractor, we've come across this, we'd like you to address it, I'm quite sure any of us would be happy to address it. And quite potentially, if we couldn't find a cure with that subcontractor, find a new subcontractor. But we'd have to know that that's the way it would go, and that we wouldn't actually be legally liable for their actions, and there would be no remuneration involved.
There isn't legal liability. I'm not sure what you mean by that. But what would happen is if registrar operator did not comply with the terms of the code of conduct.
Right.
And they were informed of the noncompliance, and they still refused to comply with the code of conduct, then the termination provisions of the agreement would kick in, possibly. And as anyone who's read the agreement knows, it is very difficult to terminate the agreement in a short time frame. So there would be ample time for any registry operator during the period of initial notice through the remedy of termination to cure that problem.
But I would suspect that you could probably find a case like this that you would be able to pursue against every registry operator on the planet at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a sword hanging over everybody's head of when someone decides to kind of invoke this, I found a subcontractor who's doing this part, and they have preferential or volume pricing that favors a registrar. I mean, it's going to be impossible for a registry operator to even be aware of that.
Well, I think
and then arbitrarily somebody's going to raise those issues, and we'll be chasing those down forever. And
yeah.
I'm not sure what we really benefit by trying to enforce on people that are providing basic services like bandwidth or DNS.
Well, I think I think if the key is the language gets changed away from subcontractor to something that's defined as a registry services
provider,
and that's clearly defined as to what's covered within that as the core registry services, then I think that's something that can be. Then if in the process
DNS.
For what?
You still have a DNS problem.
You still have a DNS problem. I mean, and then if there is a thing that, if in good faith the party acts to take, rapid to address that, if that pops up, you're not knowingly involved or something, I think that's something people can live with. But, it's one of those things that it's hard to police subcontractors.
Yeah. But I would even think that the DNS problem is not necessarily the problem if you say that the DNS services that they may be providing to the registry operator or the registry services provider is the TLD registry service. If they're providing additional services to the registrar, that's not TLD. It may be within the TLD, but it's not TLD registry.
It's not targeted at that TLD, but it could include that TLD.
Yeah, but they aren't providing the DNS services for the TLD. They're only providing it for the TLD at the registry level, right, at the second or at the top level, main level. They may be providing second level or additional DNS service that a registrar hosting provider needs, which is, to me, a very different service. So even though it's within the TLD, so I think the language about, in the designated TLD is very, very important specific here. And I think that helps exclude some of those other related services that may have some overlap within the space,
right.
But it helps define the dividing line between what's included and what's excluded.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. This is and again. I think so. We, Jonathan, you want to pick back up again on the registry?
All right. But I think all of a sudden there's a bad echo.
Yeah, we got an echo. Oh, I think it's sound.
And anyone who's
somebody go on mute, please. I'll try and move forward here. That's better. Okay, and so again, we sort of suggest that then it come down to language that says directly or indirectly show any preference, provide any special consideration, again, focused on in the designated TLD to any registrar. And then what we try to do in the next paragraph is sort of again bring the concept that exists that says that unless the same opportunities to qualify for such preferences or consideration are reasonably available to all registrars and provided
and provided. It should not be a violation of the code for the registrar to offer quantity discounts or marketing support or incentive programs that have effect of treating registrars differently based on varying business or market needs of the registrars, such as different quantities of purchases, different support requirements, or varying market requirements. And again, this was to focus, the language said that, you know, the concept here of special consideration, you know, to give the flexibility to registries to, you know, if they're trying to focus on certain business verticals, certain market segments, again, that they'd be able to do that, and that this code of conduct was not meant to override that type of activity.
I think we're okay with where you're going. We just got to study the words to make sure we appreciate the significance of them.
Understood, and, you know, not going to claim any pride of authorship in the words here, especially as we get down to the language we put in 3 and 4, because this was meant to address some concern over in 3 and 4 in our comments related to, you know, the use of data or proprietary information and what constitutes proprietary information, because everybody will claim something's proprietary information. So the really more try to address a definitional problem. I'm not sure the language I put here that I worked is the right language. I know I got a note from Kathy Kleinman that she had some concerns about this language, so I don't want to claim that this is, but, you know, really was a concern in 3 and 4 definitionally as to both what's confidential information and what's proprietary information. It's unclear what that constitutes, but also that, you know, there should be some ability to provide this, use this information that's available, you know, many current agreements allow them to monetize the data in ways to provide market information in an aggregate other basis, and I don't want to take that away from the registrars and the registries to be able to do that as long as it's offered on, you know, to reasonable terms to everybody, you know, to fairly, you know, on reasonable terms to all parties. So that's sort of the concept. I'm not sure if language here works, but that was the concept. Kathy, if she's on, may want to chime in. Are we still on?
Yes, Jonathan, this is Dan. We're hearing, following on closely and thinking about that. And I don't know if we can give more reaction than that right now, but we've looked at that, and you know, this again, I think these are provisions from older contracts, and we're just kind of trying to think through what exactly does it mean, what sort of scenarios might you have registrar data being provided to the registry or vice versa, and so we understand the drift of your comments. So,
yeah. And again, the language here is, I'm not sure is the right language, but the concept is what we want to get across, and then. I think Kathy does have a comment.
The hard part is, you know, going back or higher one level is what is I care about here, and that is really the big thing. So go ahead, please, Jonathan.
I'm going to defer to Kathy.
Kathy? Kathy, you might be on mute, or we can't hear you.
Is it possible she was muted by the operator?
It is possible.
Yes,
I'll go ahead and check while you keep talking. Kathy needs to be unmuted.
Okay, can anybody hear me? Okay, am I going to add in all day? Okay, it sounds like mine is a bad line. I will call back in.
Percent.
Jonathan, do you want to...
Do you want me to cover the other item?
Oh. Eric, is your hand a new hand up, or was that up from before?
Oh, it's up from before.
Okay, thank you.
I thought I lowered that some time ago.
The last, we'll wait for Kathy to come back in, but in the meantime, the additional change was I wanted to make clear that, you know, with respect to not, and again, you know, if we, again, to clarify that this respect registry services and within the TLD, but, you know, clarify that, you know, arm's length transactions in the ordinary course between a registry and a registrar, between a registry affiliate and a registrar or a registrar affiliate, you know, should be okay, should not be an issue, regardless of what the terms are, as long as they're entered into in the normal commercial business on type of thing. And that was just meant to be a clarification given the breadth of the language up front. But again, just focusing the language.
Yeah. So, John, and this is Kevin again. So basically here you're just saying if there's something totally unrelated to the TLD, we shouldn't be concerned about it.
Correct. And again, you know, trying to, as long as they're normal business, as long as it's nothing that comes across as, you know, clearly, you know, anybody looking at it would say, why in the world would they do that, you know? Obviously I understand they might be concerned about subterfuge at some level, but this is really, if it doesn't deal with the TLD, you shouldn't be you shouldn't have to worry about it.
Okay, we understand that.
It sounds like Kathy's back now.
Hi, is this a better connection? This is Kathy.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. I was on landline, and my landline was down for 3 hours as part of the Washington storm, so I apologize for being the one to create the static and noise on the line. Are we still in 3 and 4? Sections 3 and 4 and the changes that Jonathan proposed?
We can go back to there.
Could
we? We jumped ahead to 7 to understand 7, and we understand it, and we can work with that. If you want to,
well, if you want to finish the 7 discussion, we can finish that and then go back to 3 and 4, whatever's good.
We finished 7, so all yours on 3 and 4.
Okay. Back to 3 and 4. I understand exactly where Jonathan is going, and I was so pleased to see Sections 3 and 4, someone who worked, you know, many of us were in the Vertical Integration Working Group on this call, and 3 and 4 really capture ideas about the registry data that, you know, many of us worked really hard to explain, the value of that registry data. But here I see a bar in both 3 and 4, and it's a bar that's probably what's bothering many people, this bar about sharing the data. Whereas under current circumstances, registries can share this, you know, special registry data, but they share it equally with all registrars. A term that raised some concern on my side was reasonable access, and what does that mean, or reasonably available? So let me suggest that the term equivalent access might be the right term. It's a contractual term. It's a term that's vague, but that we're all familiar with, and that if there are situations where the registries want to make available this confidential registry data in both 3 and 4, that we provide it under similar terms of equivalent access to registrars. So again, that idea, it's available to all, or not at all. But if we have to interpret reasonably available, we may get into various interpretations of that that could go in lots of different directions, or that some people may take in directions that not other people would think is appropriate.
This is Kevin again. I think we understand the general direction. We'll probably to monkey with Jonathan's words, over which he took no pride of authorship. But I think we understand the equivalent access point.
Great. Great, because we hate to see this data available to some and not to others. If people want it should be available to all. If you're going to make it available, it shouldn't be auctioned. It shouldn't be, you know, sold off. It's to the highest bidder. It should be available to all equally. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about that.
Del Bianco, did you want to make a comment?
Craig, we can't hear you.
Can't hear me at all, huh?
Barely in the background. I think Steve Del Bianco had his hand up. I think that might have been
correct.
What Craig said.
Thank you. So it's Steve Del Bianco with NetChoice, and the business constituency took a hard look at the codes of conduct from the standpoint of dot brands. And as an example, if Canon were to get a dot brand GTLD, it might have copiers.canon or cameras.canon, and then it might even have hundreds of individual photographers with name.photos.canon. Whatever it is they do, the codes of conduct items 1, 2, and 3 are pretty much unworkable for the DOT brand. And we had a relatively simple fix for that, which we submitted in Cartagena, and it would suggest that nothing set forth in Code of Conduct Articles 1, 2, or 3 shall apply to a single registrant or DOT brand registry operator that was acting with respect to user data that is under its ownership and control, or with respect to conduct that's reasonably necessary for the management operations and purpose of the PLD. So in other words, rather than pick apart Articles 1, 2, and 3, we suggested that a DOT brand, and I realize it's careful to define that, but a DOT brand acting with respect to second-level domains that are entirely within its own control, like its own divisions, its own regional operating units, should not have to apply with Items 1, 2, or 3. Thank you.
Hey, Steve, this is Jeff. Can I ask for an example of why, what would be an element you think that would violate 1, 2, or 3 that a brand should be exempted from, just to understand it?
So that's a good question. If Canon were to set up copiers.canon, that registrant would be a wholly owned subsidiary of Canon. Agreed?
Okay, in your hypothetical, sure.
So what I worry about is Code of Conduct number one is that Canon would be showing preference and special consideration to its own internal division to get that second level domain name. And for all I know, Canon may not want to allow any unrelated parties to have any second level registrations at all.
So, okay, but you're also assuming that Canon's the registrar as well. So they're the registry
Yes, Jeff. Yes, Jeff. That it would create, I mean, I should have said that right up front, is that this is entirely hypothetical. Canon's not one of my members or clients, but if Canon set this up, it could become an accredited registrar for the purpose of tightly controlling which photographers get to post their portfolios at names.photos.canon, and they would tightly control the second level and even third level domains underneath that. I think the same could be said of any dot brand. I mean, there aren't too many that committed to launch right now, but we discussed this quite a lot in the business constituency and talk a lot about the need for flexibility at the second level.
So, Steve, but I guess my issue with that is why couldn't that apply to any single registry, whether they're, I mean, I don't even know what constitutes a dot brand other than maybe having a trademark, but even then, you know, what's to stop anyone from saying, I want to use and distribute all these names internally, and therefore I should be able to control it, and therefore I don't have to abide by any kind of code of conduct? I mean, that kind of destroys the whole vertical integration that ICANN board approved.
And I do realize that during the vertical integration discussions, the dot brand topic was continually brought up as needing some attention, but it really wasn't resolved in any form of consensus. I don't underestimate the ability of the folks on this call to imagine very creative ways in which the exception I'm speaking of could be gamed. And I realize that, and that's one of the giant challenges. But that risk of gaming doesn't swallow the need to create an opportunity for companies like Canon or Deloitte, the two of that have declared they want to run their own brand TLD.
Steve, this is Dan Haller at ICANN. Thanks again for that. And I said up front, you know, we got a lot of comments, and we'll look especially at the dot brand. I think we got comments from registries and business constituency, others, I think IPC, that we need to focus a lot on you know, that particular use case. What we've struggled with before is, you know, coming up with, and especially if you put it this way, that if you make exemptions, I think ideally we would want one code of conduct that could apply equally and prevent what people might see as abuses, whether it's a dot brand TLD, you're saying, or a not dot brand TLD, a regular old TLD. If we do carve out special rules and grant exemptions, Then we run into trouble trying to figure out who exactly is eligible and what exactly are the criteria for that, and that gets tricky, figuring out exactly, you know, how many trademarks you need, or how many regions does it have to be registered in, or how can you use those domains? Can you sell it or license out the use of those subdomains if you're the registry and the registrant? So it just gets tricky. So,
Craig, let me just respond finally. Thank you for that. But it sounds as if staff's intention is to avoid ever defining a single registrant or dot brand because it's difficult. And therefore, you're hoping that all the provisions of Module 5 would apply to everyone?
Yeah, we've tried to make a registry agreement that fits all different kinds of business models and use cases, and precisely because we don't want to spend all our time micromanaging. You know, we don't think ICANN should be in the business of kind of micro-analyzing every single second-level domain and trying to figure out what use is being put to it and who's the user and who's the beneficial user of every domain to see whether or not the registry is complying with the contract. Because that's what you get into. If we set up a category of TLDs and says, okay, we're going to treat these TLDs differently because they fall into this category, you have to precisely define what that means. And people usually, on that particular kind of category, they jump to what the use of the domain is and who's going to be using it, which then means ICANN would need to police how particular domain names are being used and who is using them. And that, you know, hopefully is something that's a little bit far removed from our sort of central, you know, our role of coordinating at the overall level the secure and stable operation of the DNS. It's a long leap to then, how is, you know, copiers.canon being used? We don't have copier experts here, and we don't know, is it okay for Canon to sublicense copiers.canon to one of their resellers or to, you know, to customers? And it just gets really tricky fast. So we're looking at it, but and we want to craft rules that address that and let kind of all cases go forward, because what this is supposed to be targeting is what the community considers to be abuses. And if the community thinks it's fine to let copiers.canon be used by Canon, then hopefully we have rules that will allow that.
Unless preventing abuse prevents me from having use. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. There's a lot we could talk about in Code of Conduct, and I'm almost kind of wishing we had more time, but we can continue this in other fora and ways. But I want to get definitely onto the last topics on termination of registry services agreement. On this, there were two subtopics. And first, does anyone need a last word on the Code of Conduct, or is it okay? We're down to like the last 15 minutes of this call here.
Can we have a give on one?
Oh, who does? Francisco? Kathy, go ahead.
Coming off mute. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. As I just posted in the chat room, Steve raises excellent, excellent points, and the Vertical Integration Working Group did not talk about that brand in any, you know, in the type of detail that it really deserved. But one of the questions raised on that brand was where the line is. And so I just wanted to raise it in this group, not with any answer, but that when we were dealing with that brand names that where the brand holder was probably interested in going out to members of the public, we knew as a working group that we got into a really gray area. The ones I posted were Google, Facebook, eBay. And it raised a number of concerns in the Vertical Integration Working Group that brand holder, we understood if IBM was issuing registrations to its employees, maybe even to its franchisees, but to go straight to the public, which is such a gray line with registrars, that I think the issue that's been raised is a very valid one, one registry code of conduct for all, because we're going to begin to get to a huge slippery slope as brand owners consider going out to the public. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
All right, thanks for that, Kathy. This is Dan again. So we're down. Unfortunately, we have to drop here in Marina Del Rey in about 7 minutes because we have another call we need to transition to. And sorry about that. 6 minutes now. But so let's quickly get into just a few minutes on the termination. The first sub-issue there, opportunity to cure, I think let me just dispose of that in 15 seconds, which is we understand the comment, and we're going to look to a way to put it in so it's not quite so draconian. And thank you for the registries for the specific wording on how to make it so it's securable and not an immediate thing where you could fall into an unintentional issue and put your agreement at risk for one conviction. So I think there's not a lot to talk about on that one. I do want to talk, though, about the SLA measurement methodologies. And I don't know, Francisco, do you want to introduce that topic or kick it to I don't know, Michael or someone else? Francisco's waving. Maybe Michael, do you want to and talk about that topic?
I can kind of give a little overview. I don't know that we have time to go through all the changes, but the existing SLAs that are in the DAG have some serious operational problems with them. And I think, should I try and describe those as well, Craig, from the beginning and move to where we went?
I think you can. We're looking at the document that you submitted to the list and still really digesting it, which is why we weren't prepared to display it today. But if you want to talk through some of the high level points on it, that would probably be helpful.
Yeah, we're on version 4, by the way, so Joe just sent that. So you guys probably want to look at that one. It's redlined from version 2, which is the first copy that you guys got. So the problem with the SLAs that were rewritten was that there are significant operational issues, and for those people that aren't that technical on the call, I'm going to use my simple 5-minute burger analogy because I think that's the easy one to understand. Today, we self-monitor, and we consider our SLA compliance and our performances from within the complexes of the registry operations data centers. And the reason we do that is because we can't really account for what happens outside those data centers in the wild west that is the internet. So the analogy that I'd like to say is that today we offer a 5-minute hamburger where the customer comes up to the counter and orders a hamburger at the counter. Once they put the order in, we've got 5 minutes to turn around the hamburger. The new version of the SLAs changed that metric to actually considering the performance of delivering that hamburger for when the customer leaves their door, their front door, if you will. So now I don't know what's going on with the customer between them and the front door of my burger shop. They could be, you know, stopping in at various places. They could take any number of roads to get there. I have no control over it, so clearly I have a real hard time now with committing to a 5-minute burger for that customer because I don't know if they live, next block over or if they're in the next state. So that's the fundamental problem. We talked about that at length in an initial meeting at Cartagena and trying to understand why the changes came about. Francisco was very helpful in giving us some insights into what ICANN was trying to accomplish. What ICANN's really, I'll paraphrase this, so if I get it wrong, Craig or Francisco, please correct me, but our understanding of what ICANN wanted to accomplish was basically to be aware of when a registry operator's in trouble, not find out about it way after the fact. And be ready to take any appropriate action in terms of emergency action, such as, you know, the registry operator just cannot maintain their commitment in a worst-case scenario, and emergency registry transition procedures need to be initiated. And really what they're trying to do was put enough support in to make that happen in those rare cases where registry operator has really defaulted on their operational responsibilities. And maybe because they've gone bankrupt or whatever reason. So what we did in this attempt with the SLAs is we tried to separate the issues of emergency escalation and emergency response and failure conditions with general SLA conformance and good monitoring practices. We separated it into two concepts, basically, escalations, emergencies, and SLA monitoring and conformance. And then we took SLA conformance and we split that into two blocks of services. One service is really about public services, so critical operational services that the public consumes in regards to registry operations, which we defined effectively as DNS and WHOIS services. And then the other block of services fall under services between contracted parties. In other words, services between registry operators and registrars, and in turn, registrars to their registrants. Okay? And that really is about the SRS and EPP transactions. So I think that's, you know, as much as I'm going to get in the time that we have allotted left to give you kind of an introduction to it. So I hope that wraps everyone's heads around what we were trying to do is make it a very realistic operational goal for us to support, you know, good SLA practices, good due process, yet also not make it and support emergency transition issues, but also not make the process of supporting those things impossible or put ourselves in situations where we just know it's operationally inconceivable.
Okay, Michael, this is Dan at ICANN. Thank you very much for that and for your hard work on this and the others who've contributed on that. I think the next step will be for ICANN to take the your latest draft and kind of develop a red line from the last version of the proposed final applicant guidebook so we can see where you're at, and then we will try and comment on that and continue working towards it. You know, we've still been committed to the idea of being able to see it from outside. We understand there's a difference of opinion about how the right way to measure it, so we'll keep working on that. And thank you again for the hard work, and we'll keep working on that particular part.
Yeah, and Dan, let me just clarify. The reason we broke into public services and services between contracted parties, public services are still being monitored from the outside. That is something that's a concession point we're trying to make here. And and there is also a emergency escalation path added for registrars, a formal one, if they feel that they are running into critical service issues directly with registry operators, and registry operators are not being responsive to them and not servicing them, they have the option of running an emergency escalation back through ICANN.
Yeah, we thought that was particularly useful, and we like the idea of having a trigger for a quick emergency escalation kind of between ICANN and the registry operator, too. So that was good stuff, and thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're up against our deadline. Craig, is there any, can you help us close the call out, please?
Sure, and thanks again to everyone for participating. A lot of good discussion, and we have some next steps and some writing to get back to the group, and it sounds like you do as well. And what we should probably do is touch base within the next week or two to determine if having another call would be beneficial or if we can actually just handle progress forward on the list. Does anyone have any final closing comments? I know the ICANN folks are pressed right up against the wall for time, but if someone from the registry stakeholder group or on the phone would like to make a last comment, we'll do that and then close out the call.
Yeah, I mean, so this is Jeff. Just a last comment. Thanks for having this. And, you know, I would encourage another call, but after you guys can submit comments back to us or even drafting language back to us, I think that's when we made the most progress several months ago when we were in Marina Del Rey, is when you guys actually had language that we could look at and comment in real time. That would be great.
Thanks, Jeff. And thanks again to everyone on the call. And,
thanks for the comments, Jeff. We'll try to see if we can do that, and we really appreciate everybody's efforts and all the information you provided today.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Craig?
Left.
Take care, all. Bye-bye.